Welcome to the EBXML and Related Technologies Awareness Series. My name is Sascha Schlegel. I'm working for Cyclone Commerce X-Way. Today is June 7th, 2006. Today's topic is the Universal Business Language. And my guests today are John Bozak and Tim McGrath. Hi, John.
Hello, Sascha.
And hi, Tim.
Hi, Sascha.
John Bozak is Distinguished Engineer of the CTO Office at Sun Microsystems. John has been involved with XML, the Extensible Markup Language. Later, he has been involved with the EBXML framework, and now he's involved with the Universal Business Language. John, it seems your projects are always very, very ambitious. Please tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, I think the projects I tend to be involved in are always very, very obvious. I can't think of anything in the last 10 years or so I've been involved in that didn't represent some terribly obvious objective that needed to be accomplished, and it was simply a matter of helping provide some organization around it. My own background technically is actually in technical writing, and I became involved with what's called markup languages as a result of hypertext work in the late 1980s and early 1990s. When I worked for Novell, I became in charge of Novell's effort to put all of their printed documentation online, and in the course of that, we developed some very sophisticated electronic publishing tools built around an ISO standard called SGML, and as a result of that work, I became involved in the early World Wide Web and in the effort to apply SGML technology to the web, and that's what became XML. So that's how I got involved in this.
Thank you. And Tim is co-author of two books I'm aware of. One is the EBXML Professionals, and the second one is Document Engineering. Tim has been involved in business-to-business for quite some time. He has a vast EDI experience and knowledge. Currently, Tim is traveling the world and teaching in various universities. Hi, Tim. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Okay, yes. Look, first of all, I have to do a small disclaimer. Professional EBXML book was really a very small contribution on my behalf, so I'm not really sure I can claim a lot of credit for that. But as you point out, I became involved in markup languages much later than John. I came from an EDI background, and EBXML was my first exposure to XML and the principles of markup. And the one thing I think in the 6 years that I've now been involved with that technology and standards making in that area is the tremendous opportunities I see from leveraging the perspectives of people who have a publishing and markup background and the perspectives of people who come at this with a information systems or data processing background. So it really is we're in a very opportune period of technology here to create a synergy between two different fields of endeavor. So my role is particularly with UBL has been focused very clearly onto the content side of UBL, the semantic side of it rather than the technical side. In that sense, I think projects like UBL have been a great experience for bringing together a diverse group of people. And you introduced this by saying to Jono is chooses ambitious projects. I think what Jono is does is choose a rather eclectic mix of people to work on these projects, and somehow the magic happens when that all comes together.
Okay, So let's ask John. John, what is the universal business language?
Well, UBL is actually an extremely simple concept. It's a set of a royalty-free set of standard electronic forms for common business documents, meaning things like purchase orders and invoices and shipping notices. It's a very simple concept that turns out to be pretty hard to implement. The first set of eight XML document types was released as an OASIS standard in November 2004, and version 2, which contains around 30 document types, will be released about the same time this year, about 2 years after version 1. So that's basically it.
Okay. John, please tell us a little bit more about the history of UBL. Where is UBL coming from?
Well, actually, the history can be looked at in two different ways. Historically, the UBL effort came out of EBXML, because EBXML, as listeners to the other interviews in this series know, was an effort to basically create an XML and Internet version of EDI. And when that effort decided in, I think, 2000, that it would not be creating a common set of XML schemas for the documents themselves, that's the point at which I started recruiting people to provide such a thing. So from a historical standpoint, where we're coming from directly is an effort to fill out that part of the EBXML stack that requires standards for the documents that are interchanged themselves. So that's one way of looking at it. Technically, we go back a lot further than that. Technically, we go back, at this point, almost 8 years. The first implementation of a language that would become UBL was called CBL, Common Business Language. And that was developed back around 1997 by a little startup company called VO Systems. And they released CBL 1.0 with funding from the U.S. National Institute of Science and Technology, or NIST. And as a result of that, that first release of CBL was in the public domain, so it didn't have licensed ownership. Then Commerce One acquired VO and spent another year or so building out CBL into something that would work for Commerce One's electronic marketplaces. So a lot of work went into that, and that was released as CBL 2.0. Then Commerce One partnered with SAP to produce yet another revision, and in this cycle, Commerce One and SAP put a great deal of effort into reviewing the two dominant EDI messaging standards, which are EDIFACT and X12, and making sure that the third revision of CBL would include semantics from EDI, so it could support EDI-type functionality. And that was released as XCBL 3.0, because by that time you had to have an X in the name for it to be taken seriously. So that's how things stood when we started the UBL effort in 2001. And we started with the contribution of XCBL 3.0 by Commerce One and SAP to the UBL effort. So one of the things I think that distinguishes what we're doing from a lot of other efforts is that we decided, instead of being purists and starting with just a set of requirements and building from there, we started with something that was already being used and that was already deployed and already did a pretty good job. So what we've done over the last 5 years is build on that. So that's the other side of where we came from.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Tim, from your point of view, with your EDI experience and know-how, was it just a differentiation based on XML, or was there more to UBL than EDI business documents?
Well, yeah, look, as John said, the genesis of the organization or the technical committee we now know as UBL did come from the EBXML project. Those people who've been following these discussions may be aware that EBXML, in terms of defining the content of messages to be exchanged in an EBXML framework, did leave a gap there, quite deliberately and specifically, to say that EBXML would not define in itself the messages. But what they would define was the methodology for defining messages. And this is really where the influence of the EDI perspective came into it. Many of the people who've been involved in developing EDI standards, and I'm not one of those, but many of those involved in EDI standards development who participate in EBXML development had already been through two or three generations of syntax change. Having designed purchase orders for GTDI, then for EDIFACT, and then for subsequent releases of EDIFACT or X12, these people thought that they'd had enough of defining syntax-dependent semantic models, and so the principle behind EBXML was to define a syntax-neutral environment for defining documents, and then the same document models could be implemented using EDIFACT, X12, XML, or whatever other syntax people chose to use. So the deliverable that came out of EBXML that is relevant to the work that we're doing in UBL is the thing called the Core Component Technical Specification. And this is the document that defines what you should call and how you should structure the components in your documents. In UBL's case, we were quite clearly and unequivocally defining documents for XML. So we were, if you like, our objective was to take the core component technical specification, apply that to XCBL, and produce a XML implementation of that. And on the way, we did some refinement to those models based upon various reviews and feedback and input from members of the public and the TC. So, yes, the aspect of EDI and EBXML in this work is really in that area of applying the principles of the core component technical specification to defining an XML vocabulary. And that's what we've achieved that. I think as far as we know, UBL is the first and probably still only publicly available royalty-free library of XML components defined using the EBXML core component technical specification. And, you know, that was an historical decision that we deliberately made when we started UBL. I think very recently now we're seeing that has been a strategically wise decision, given and I guess I'm leaping ahead to a future question here, but seeing where other organizations are heading in terms of their development of XML vocabularies, I think we're seeing that EBXML and the core component technical specification is now a bit of a benchmark for all of these groups.
Yes, it's good that Tim pointed that out. If we have changed so much in the last 5 years, we've built so much on top of the original XCBL contribution that you can hardly tell where it came from anymore. So it would be hard to list all the differences, but probably the largest difference that we've made in the last 5 years is the based on the core component technical specification. The original XCDL contribution we started with had this essential idea of a component library, and that's very important because it means that all of our document types are not developed in isolation. They're all based by assembling the documents from the same library of XML components. Mm-hmm. And that was true back in XCBL. The big difference is that our components from the beginning of the UBL effort have been based on the core component semantic concept.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you the question, so what do you try to achieve? What's your goal? What's your motivation? Let me elaborate. If many software systems can produce and consume all these universal business language business documents, and hence many organizations would exchange these UBL business documents, what has then been achieved? What are the economical results of this?
Well, the key economic result is that through standardization, you've made possible off-the-shelf, inexpensive business software to handle these functions. And we're only in the process now of trying to achieve that. We haven't actually achieved that yet, but that standardization is essential to the goal, in my view, and this isn't necessarily the view of all the participants, by the way. But in my view, we're on the edge of a major economic shift in this area, and this is the same kind of shift we've seen over and over again in the history of computing, where you start with what a cottage industry, as you might call it in English, of vendors who create custom, very expensive custom systems for specific applications. And after many years of development, finally through standardization, it becomes possible to address not all the requirements, not everyone's requirements 100%, but enough requirements in, that people will adopt something because it's now inexpensive. And we've seen this with operating systems. We've seen this with programming languages. We saw this with hypertext systems. We saw this with publishing systems. You see the same story over and over again, where you go from a typical implementation costing $500,000 to a typical implementation costing $500. And this may be what we're seeing now in business document exchange software systems. So if there's one overriding economic consequence of this, if successful, it would be yet another case where standardization has created a market for inexpensive off-the-shelf software.
Mm-hmm. Tim, when I met you first, one of my questions was whether EBXML was helping the small and business enterprises. So same question this time. Does UBL help all these small companies to participate, to engage in business-to-business electronic commerce?
Yeah, look, I believe it has the potential to, and as John points out, we're certainly not there yet. Let me cast back again to the comment I made before about the perspective within the EBXML development area that as far as documents were concerned, I think the mantra that was chanted at the time was, we don't need yet another purchase order specification. I now believe that was wrong. The world does need another purchase order specification, and it needs a simple one based on XML that people who provide software to small and medium-sized enterprises can hardwire into their applications. This is actually the biggest gain in this whole area is from the lowest technology. You know, it is a case, I believe, where we have tried to engineer a sophisticated solution that would be useful for large organizations. As far as EBXML goes, in terms of the content, the way UBL has approached this is, no, we will make the decisions about what we think should be a purchase order, and we will then decide that people allow people to build these things into their applications. There's a common myth about small and medium enterprises. I mean, they don't care. They don't really make decisions about whether they will use UBL or EBXML or X12 or EDIFACT or OAG. They don't make those decisions. Mm-hmm. They don't care. The people who build their software make those decisions, and the people who build their software make those decisions based upon where they perceive the market will be and whether what they perceive will give value to their clients. I believe that, one of the basic principles of success in this area has to be based upon choosing the 80-20 solution, the technology that may not be perfect but provides 80% of what the market requires. And although we're not there yet, we're seeing some evidence of that appearing. So it's encouraging from the UBL perspective. I do believe that we will see UBL embedded into applications for small and medium enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Semantics is a kind of a difficult word to me. Maybe it's just a language. But what does semantic mean to you in regards to your work with UBL? Maybe questions for John.
Well, actually, Tim is a bit closer to the semantic technology we're using, the CCTS. But I'll say something and then turn it to him to fill out.
Yep.
Semantics means meaning. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when we talk about semantics, we're talking about how do we establish the meaning of something. And this is one of the great difficult questions, not just to computer science, but of language and philosophy. And the only way, I'm kind of a primitivist myself, the only way I see to establish semantics is to get everybody into a room and then work out a prose description of what you're talking about. But much more complex and sophisticated ways of approaching this have been developed. CCTS is one of those. The various ontology technologies are other ways of approaching this, and people are working on even more distant ways. But Tim, maybe you could fill that out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you say you're primitivist, John. I think we shouldn't oversell the idea of technologies such as CCTS or even formal ontologies as being particularly advanced in this area as well. There is, as John points out, there's a really fundamental problem about semantics that is to do with language, and in fact it's not even to do with language, it's to do with meaning, how we understand things as human beings, and UBL is not going to solve that problem, because many of us like to think there's a simple solution to this. There's a lot of effort goes into trying to make very precise specifications for defining semantics. And I guess this is where I depart somewhat from the sort of views of many of the, the academic and the researchers in this area, that there's a belief that you can formalize these things. The more I look at it, the more I think John is probably correct. The meaning of things is whatever the group of people using that thing want it to mean. And we can try in many ways to introduce some rigor to that way we describe semantics, but ultimately we will never be able to formalize those. We will have to come to mutual agreement about what these things are. And the way we've approached that within UBL, yes, we have adopted the semantic framework of EBXML, the core component technical specification. But really, that semantic framework is very loose. It really revolves very closely around naming, and the naming of an object is really only a very small part of defining its semantics, defining what it means. You know, it doesn't. Yes, it's good to have a rigorous way of applying names to objects so that they are consistent and not duplicated and no synonyms around. Ultimately, you do end up having to rely upon things like narrative descriptions, business rules expressed in a language, and lots of other metadata to describe what this object really is. So I think we can certainly use some of the experience of people working in areas like ontology, formal ontologies and the semantic web experience. But ultimately, that isn't the path that's going to lead us to interoperable business documents. Even though we would like to believe that there's a science here, this isn't a science, it's an art or a craft at best. One of the really fascinating things about doing the work of UBL has been to be engaged with many non-English speaking people, especially in the Asian community, about defining what we mean by semantics and, how do we describe the meaning of things. And once you start to break out of that single language barrier, defining semantics, the problem becomes quite clear that you're really trying to express a set of business rules in some consistent way. And relying upon language itself is not enough. The words are not enough to describe the meaning. That's the bottom line to this problem. And what we do with UBL, we use the EBXML sort of core component technical specification as a base, but really the skill and the art is in how you apply that. Creating the names is just a relatively simple part of that. But what things you need to create, what are the rules that apply to those objects, how do those objects relate to other objects, that is the skill in developing a semantic vocabulary. I'm increasingly of the belief that that is not a formalizable exercise. It's a consultative exercise.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But one of the things I think we should observe here is that once you step away from the really deep problem of how you establish meaning in the first place, a lot of what the semantic technologies like CCTS are trying to accomplish is really functionally fairly straightforward. They're trying to establish a way to map things to each other. Okay, so in other words, if we only had one vocabulary for expressing business documents, we really wouldn't need to establish a semantic substrate. The only reason that we require that we have to have that, is because we have multiple approaches. And what we're trying to do is say, well, if I get a purchase order in one form and my software is set up to process it in another form, how do I get from this point to that point? And that's a mapping exercise. So, in other words, if a given term is ship date over here and it's ship by over there, and we want to know whether these two things mean the same thing, and that's the functional reason that we need to establish this apparatus around all this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's what I call the equivalence problem. Yes. How do you know something is equivalent to something else?
So one way to do that, and I've seen this in various initiatives, is to form a giant spreadsheet of in which all the columns are, you know, this format, this format, and this format. And then going across, you try and link these things up. So you say, well, this one from this format is equivalent to that one in that format. And the approaches such as CCTS are trying for a much more sophisticated and deeper understanding of the problem. And they're doing that by saying, well, let's define the core semantic concept to begin with, and then by describing the way that that concept is realized in these different formats, we get the mapping. So that's yeah, kind of the effort there.
Yeah, and I'd have to say that the idea, the principle behind the core component work of EBXML is correct, these things must always start from an abstract syntax neutral model of the information that is required. You know, an important aspect of this is to get rid of the constraints that the various technologies bring. I used to think it was because I was a technophobe that I was cautious about designing schemas using schema languages, but now I believe it's the right principle, is that you know, you really need to, if you want to solve this equivalence problem, to get away from this idea of having to map everything to everything else, then you have to distill it back down into a syntax neutral meaning. And the core components architecture is really the most logical place to start with that.
Let's talk about something else. From the UBL project, you had other very valuable outcomes. For example, the naming and design rules, I think also new codeless methodologies. Can you tell a little bit more about what else you have done in the UBL project?
Well, I think you're pointing to two of the key ones. I would add to that probably the International Data Dictionary as a practical point. That's a very direct way of addressing semantics. We've simply got all of our 600-plus terms that are used in UBL, and their English definitions translated now into two forms of Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Spanish, and we now have a team working on Italian. So that was an important extra deliverable. The naming and design rules were never really intended as a model for everyone to follow, but we had such a great amount of expertise that went into that, that in fact a lot of other organizations have picked up our naming and design rules, either in whole or in part, and that includes UNCFACT, which is based on, their naming and design rules are based almost entirely on ours, and you have other organizations like the United States Department of the Navy adopted our naming and design rules, and other agencies and groups are using it. So that was important. The new codeless methodology, I think, is extremely important in potentially. Most people are not aware of it yet, and we're still trying to get input on it. Basically, what we're doing there is we have wrestled with the problem of code lists since we started. It's a terrible problem.
Please explain what is the code list problem, maybe.
Yes. Well, by code list, we simply mean, for example, the ISO list of currency or of country codes, and the list of currency codes and so forth. Mm-hmm. And these appear as values, of course, in individual UBL documents. So, for example, if I'm trying to express a price, then I'm going to have an attribute for which currency I'm using, and that attribute may have a code of EUR for euro, or it may have CAD for Canadian dollars, or USD for US dollars, and so on. And so when you begin with this, you think, well, we have all these standard codes. The only problem we have here is just making sure that the value that appears in a document is one of the standard codes.
Yep.
So if you get EUR, the software checks and says, yeah, that's a standard code value. Whereas if you get XYZ, it says, no, that's not a code value, that's an error. Turns out that this is a much more complicated problem than that for several reasons. Just for starters, these lists tend to be updated, you know, at various points. Countries are created or they disappear, or currencies are created or disappear, and you need some way of updating the software that has that had this code list embedded in it. So that's one kind of problem. More difficult and actually more common problem is that trading partners may wish to use variant versions of these code lists. So, for example, if you're a company that only trades with the United States and say France, then you might want to restrict your code list values to just euros and U.S. dollars, and that's not exactly a validity check anymore. That's more of a business rule check. So we start going from a strict concept of valid values to more of a concept of which values are we going to allow as kind of a business rule filter. And then it gets more complicated than that, because what you'd really like to do is say, well, we want the currency list acceptable for this part of the document, say the buyer, to be different slightly from the one for seller or something like that, or for addresses to be different between these two. So in the original approach that we used in UBL1, we took a very orthodox sort of treatment by taking standard code lists and codes that we define just for UBL and specifying those as enumerations directly in the schemas. So we're using these W3C schemas, which have the XSD extension, so we often call them XSD schemas. And in 1.0, we simply baked in these long lists of values as allowable enumerations. But that didn't solve any of the other problems I just described. Mm-hmm. So a lot of thought went into this. I can't even relate to you all the discussions we've had internally about this.
Yeah.
But finally, a few months ago, I think we achieved a real breakthrough in abandoning the idea that all validation would be done in the W3C schema phase.
Yeah.
And we now have a model in which, at least conceptually, you don't have to do this, but conceptually, you're going to validate a UBL2 document by first checking the XML schemas, the W3C schemas, for that document,
mm-hmm.
and then in a second pass, using XSLT, which is another XML technology, to actually check the values of the codes. And this is a very powerful approach, because what it means is that you've conceptually separated the task of checking a document into two really distinct phases. In the first phase, you're checking the document for structure and vocabulary, and that's what W3C schemas are good for.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second phase, you're checking the actual values that get used in the document. Okay, and once you make that distinction, suddenly you have a framework that can be extended in really amazingly powerful ways. For example, it then becomes very easy for two trading partners to say, we're going to use this version of, for example, a list of states or provinces. We're going to use this version for the buyer, but we're going to use a different version for the seller. And that becomes trivially easy to implement. Another thing you can do is update these things, because the way we've got them now is we're externalizing the description of the code lists themselves into their own standard XML format.
Mm-hmm.
And that format is called Genericode. And at this point, Genericode is a proposal that has been circulated widely for about the last year and a half. And in fact, right now, an Oasis TC is in the process of formation to standardize generic code. So and that's not a UBL thing. That could apply to anybody's use of CodeLess. The result of that, when they're done, will be a standard XML form for CodeLess. And the hope is that CodeLess providers, like ISO, for example, will publish their CodeLess in that form. And that, just by itself, that's a huge breakthrough mm-hmm. for everyone who uses CodeLess, because we now have a standard representation of CodeLess. But in our framework, this opens the door to implementing a lot of other basic business rule checking at the validation level, okay, so that you can now say, for example, something that's impossible to say in XSD schema, which is, okay, over here is the price, and I've checked, and it's euros. That's good, because that's on my list of allowable currency codes. And over there, I've checked the country, and it's France, and that's good because France is on my list of trading partners. But now I can go further and say, if it's France, it must be euros. Mm-hmm. And that kind of logic is impossible in XSD, and it's trivially easy using XSLT. So you can start actually using that validation phase as a very powerful filter for keeping bad input out of your back-end processing. That's what it boils down to.
Let's go ahead and please let us know about some successful UBL implementations, or if you are aware of organizations, governments looking seriously at UBL. What's going on outside of the technical committee? How are people picking up UBL?
Yeah, I guess UBL 1.0, as John said before, covered a set of business documents, the basic procurement business process, so from order to invoice. And we deliberately tried to keep the context of use for those documents as broad as possible. UBL itself is a open source type development. The UBL specifications are available to anyone to download and use. We have no real way of, nor do we necessarily want to have a real way of monitoring who is using UBL and what are they using it for.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way we ever really understand what UBL is being used for is if somebody comes back and tells us. And probably the most significant one of those, about 18 months ago, we were contacted by the Department of Finance of the Danish government to say that they had actually passed an act of parliament in Denmark to mandate the use of electronic invoices to the Danish government. And those invoices were based upon UBL 1.0. Now, that's a significant decision for any government to make, and it certainly has meant the adoption of UBL in Denmark has been widespread. Not only do we have many millions of UBL-based invoices going into the Danish government, but of course, the software providers who support those applications that create those invoices are now able to send XML UBL-based invoices to other customers as well. And we're seeing some propagation of that outside of the government area. There's been an almost a domino effect within Northern Europe, where we've had equally eager acceptance from Sweden, Norway, parts of the British government, and Iceland, I believe, and Finland are on the list, so much so that we actually now have what we call a Northern European subset group, which is a bit like, I guess, a UBL user group in Northern Europe, who are working together to define common profiles for their particular contexts. So that's been a significant implementation. In front of me, I don't have the exact figures. John might have a few more figures that we can give you on the sort of numbers and the economics of that. But as I said before, we didn't target UBL at being e-government procurement. It just so happens to be that group have picked up and run with it. And we're now aware, for example, that there are significant implementations out in the area of international trade and transport. So we have groups of people in Hong Kong, in Korea, in Singapore, who are using UBL documents now for their international business exchange, the transport documents. So, there's been a very broad set of adoptions and it still quite amazes me. I visited Madrid a month ago to catch up with one of the chairs of our Spanish localization subcommittee, and whilst I was there, I was presented to two different government departments and two large software houses, all of whom have been implementing UBL for at least a year, and we just weren't aware of it. So there's a lot of activity out there. We can only sense the very tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it turns out that one of the technical definitions of an open standard is that it's not audited. In other words, it's not tracked, because that's something that would go hand in hand with licensing and with fees, and we don't do that. We're out there for anybody to use freely. So there is no mechanism for determining who's using UBL, and consequently we're periodically surprised by, as Tim was in Madrid, by discovering that things are in progress. I can give you some figures. Just based on some of the Northern European things. In Denmark, they're currently exchanging 1.2 million invoices a month. They estimate savings from that to the government at about 100 million euros annually. They expect that figure to double next year when they go live with the UBL purchase order as well. In Sweden, a press release came out a few months ago. The Swedish agency responsible for determining these things is basically mandating UBL for use by various government bodies. Their estimate of savings over the next 5 years was, I believe, 2 billion kroner, which, if you work it out, comes out to about $100 million U.S. a year. So that's very close to the Danish estimate, but they haven't actually implemented that yet. Our Northern European group, as Tim pointed out, has Denmark, Norway, Sweden, the UK, Finland, Iceland, and I've heard rumors that that's going to be joined by a couple of other countries as well. There's also a project that's just started up, driven by Italy, called Abilities. We don't know very much about that. But we do know they claim to have, this is based on UBL, and they have EU-funded projects going in Lithuania, Slovakia, Romania, and Turkey. So that's the other end of Europe there coming on board. And as I said, there's no doubt a lot of other things going on here that we'll find out later.
Yeah, look, and I should just add here that one of the indicators of I think, the industry acceptance of UBL has been that since we've developed UBL 1.0, for the last 18 months we've been working on the development of UBL 2.0, and the participants, the people working on UBL now, are in the main from organizations who have adopted and implemented UBL 1. So we're actually, UBL is now being developed by people who are using UBL. Whereas, I guess, in UBL, the first version, we were kind of working in theory. We're now working very much in practice. So that's another, I think, the fact that people have adopted this and see value in making further investment in developing the standard is all a healthy sign, I think, in terms of how well UBL is addressing the market need.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the interview. There are many, many more interesting topics for UBL. Let us know where it is now and where it's going tomorrow.
If I go first and then let John wrap up.
Maybe. Okay.
John is currently the chair of UBL and I'm the vice chair, so I guess, you know, we both of us have a sort of strong investment in the success and the development of UBL. But whenever we get up and talk about it, one of the phrases that I particularly like to use is to describe UBL as the HTML of web commerce. In other words, the model that we would like to follow, the model of adoption, is very much the way that the HTML technology was adopted. That somebody somewhere, sometime, is going to have to define a set of tags for defining business objects. And as far as I'm concerned, UBL is the one that we should be using for that. And what the market needs is the HTML for web commerce. So that's, I guess, when I describe UBL in a nutshell, that's the phrase I like to use.
Okay, thank you. And John?
Well, before I give a summary here, I have to give a plug for the company that has funded the chairmanship of this effort from the beginning and supported all of its telephone calls and a number of its meetings, and that's my employer, Sun Microsystems, which, as usual, is doing this out of a regard for open standards. And consequently doesn't stand to make any money from it. So I try and give them a plug when I can. What I'd have to say about UBL is it's real. It's being used very successfully right now. It's being adopted by a growing number of governments as a data standard for government procurement. And what that means is that support for UBL is going to be built into all common off-the-shelf business software. That's inevitable. Just the adoptions we've got already will guarantee that. And what that means is that all small business software in a few years will have built-in support for UBL simply because of these government mandates. What that means as a result is that that now becomes transparently available to these businesses for trade between each other. And I think that's really going to change the landscape here economically. Also, this is very important, we now have a clear upgrade path into future versions of UBL that are going to be developed by UNCFAC, which is, of course, the body responsible for EDIFACT and international trade facilitations. So any misgivings that people might have had about future international recognition for UBL are in the process of being taken care of, and this is a really good time to get on board, both with implementation and with participation in the effort itself.
Tim and John, thank you very much for your time for this interview, and I wish you the best luck you can have.
Thank you, Sasha.
Thank you, Sasha.